This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia, and every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. The notion that fire knows no borders continues to ring true this summer from Jasper, Alberta to the American West Coast. Wildfires have left their mark on so many communities in North America and around the world, and on the minds and memories of those who call these communities home. Viet Thanh Nguyen is a writer, professor, a Vietnamese refugee to the United States, and a self-described scholar of memory. His books include A Man of Two Faces, The Refugees, and The Sympathizer, which was recently adapted for television. And much of the Pulitzer Prize-winning author's work examines how trauma shapes our narrative and emotional recollection. Viet's latest book is written for children. It is called Simone, and it's about a young girl and her mom fleeing home in the face of fire. Viet, hi. It's nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me again, Pia.
So let's start by having you read just a bit from Simone. This is a conversation between her and her mom, and it's told from Simone's perspective.
Okay. Wake up, baby. Wake up. What's wrong, Matt? We have to go, Simone. Get what's important. Fire. Evacuate now. I grab my go bag. Band-aids, flashlight, clothes. But what about the things I love? Let's go, Simone. I can't decide. Bring some books. We've got to go, baby. Isn't this your favorite toy? I love all my books, but I couldn't take them all. I'll be back for you. I'd never seen anything like this before. It was like a movie, but it was real life.
So that's from the start of the book. Viet, you know, what's so interesting to me is that there's no buildup, there's no euphemism, no sugarcoating what's going on. It just really begins sort of abruptly with scenes of fire. I'm guessing that was quite a conscientious decision for you. So why approach the story that way?
I think it's a reality of life for so many of us now in many different countries. The possibility of sudden evacuations, fires, things like that, certainly something that I have thought about a lot, especially since I've become a father and have children and have to worry about things like go bags and so on. And as a story, I just wanted to immerse readers right away into this emergency that Simone and her mother are facing.
I think even when communities know a fire may be approaching and authorities say, you know, get the stuff together, even if they are prepared, that last moment where you sort of look around and do what Simone sort of does, which is, oh my God, like panic a little bit and say, like, what am I going to take? Have I taken all, not just the essentials, but the things that make me human and that I love and keep so dear?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, our go bags have all of the human essentials in terms of food and water and things like that. But what Simone is facing is a sentimental and an emotional evacuation. Like what symbolic things really matter to her? Obviously, that's true for adults, but you know, for children, and certainly magnified when their entire world can be reduced simply to a teddy bear or to a precious book or toy.
You mentioned your go bag, just so people know. You grew up in California. You live in that state. California has seen so many wildfires over the years. I'm wondering, Viet, what has it been like for you to see and experience fires and the threat of fires in your home state for so many years?
It's interesting because I think as a Californian, I've grown up with the reality of earthquakes my entire life. So even when an earthquake hits, as happened a week or two ago, it was scary, but you know, it's normal. But fires, I think, are of the scale that we're facing now all over the world. That's something completely new. And there's something apocalyptic about smoke and ash and the sky turning orange and evacuation orders and watching the slowly approaching line of the evacuation zone coming closer and closer, as happened to my father. His evacuation line banking within a couple blocks of his house. And so there's something much more slow moving about a fire, even if the initial crisis is very abrupt, but you can see that fire coming if you're lucky. And so I think that's, you know, changed the psychology for me and probably for many others. And it's a symptom. I mean, fires themselves are slow moving in the sense that even if it's not fire season now, we know it's going to be fire season soon. And so I think that does change our perception of our safety and our relationship to our homes and this whole psychology of always being ready to leave.
And I suppose having kids, especially young kids who can't fend for themselves as way as older kids could probably is an added dynamic. In other words, if you were just taking care of yourself, yet, or there were, you know, you and your partner, that's one way to think about, like, what are we going to do if fire approaches? How am I going to think about it? That psychology you talk about. But then you have kids in the picture and it's different and more complex, I imagine.
I think everything with kids, obviously. But, you know, writing the book from a child's point of view is also an opportunity to think about the dangerous world through the eyes of innocence and what they might be worried about and how their perceptions of things are different. And of course, there's something very emotional about that for anybody who has kids or thinks about kids. But I think, you know, the reverse is also true, that seeing the world through a child's point of view might make us, hopefully as adults, rethink our own assumptions. You know, things that we might take for granted and that we think we could deal with on our own might look radically different if we think about how children might view them or how subsequent generations might view the kinds of consequences of our human decisions. I don't think any of that's explicit in the book, but hopefully that's in the background for parents or adults who are reading this book with their kids.
Hmm. In the book, the wildfires, Ramon Simone's mom of being displaced by floods in Vietnam, where she had immigrated from. Why was it important for you to connect the dots between those modern day fire experiences with her mom's memories, like sort of through the generations, like here's sort of an analogy that we can both, you know, circle around?
Well, I wanted to make the book specifically about children, obviously, but also about Vietnamese children as well, or a Vietnamese child. I mean, that idea that representations are important and we want to see our faces and our stories in these images was certainly in my own mind. And then it wasn't very much of a connection at all to connect fire here with flooding in Vietnam, because that's a historical reality. There really are and were floods of massive scale in scales in Vietnam that displaced so many people. And I think that is something that binds us as human beings. You know, we are carving out our cities and our towns and so on in these natural landscapes, and we're confronting the realities of nature, which is always going to be present. And so I think hopefully there's something very specific about that Vietnamese experience, but also something quite universal that people all over the world are confronting very parallel kinds of situations.
I'm glad you mentioned the word displacement. So much of your work explores the impact of conflict, of war, and displacement. So let's talk about how you're thinking about that intersection of climate and conflict now in the fall of 2024. How are you seeing those, you know, things coming together?
Well, when we talk about a refugee crisis, which is obviously very much in the forefront of so many political and cultural conversations, we tend to think of refugees as a problem. They're threatening us and so on and so forth. And they become very foreign and very alien, and they become objects to our own subjects. That's because the kinds of catastrophes that have displaced refugees can seem very remote to people who are not refugees, things like war and political catastrophe and so on. But climate disaster is something that knows no borders and is something that's going to affect all of us. So I think the phenomenon of climate refugees will hopefully make those of us who have not thought about the refugee experience before or thought about refugees in a positive light make us reconsider what the nature of a refugee is, because we're all threatened by climate disaster, no matter how wealthy we might be and no matter where we might be geographically. And so the closeness of climate disaster and the possibility of any of us losing our homes, whether it's because of flood or fire or rising seas and so on, I think that's my hope, is that it will make us reconsider the idea of displacement as being something that is not just about them, these faraway people, but it's also about us as well.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Viet Thanh Nguyen, whose 2015 debut novel, The Sympathizer, won the Pulitzer Prize. Well, Viet has a new children's book out. This one is called Simone. So beyond fiction, in essays and op-eds and many of your writings, you delve into politics. And by taking part in protests on issues, including police brutality and solidarity with Palestinians amid the Israel-Hamas war, I want to talk to you about that solidarity piece. You have made the case that Asian American identity is one that is built upon a politics of solidarity. What do you mean by that?
I mean that it's easy in some ways for us to be self-interested if we feel that we're being attacked for whatever reason, because of our identity or because of our location or our politics. And it's easy to mobilize in self-defense around our self-interest. But solidarity is really what's going to liberate all of us, not just liberate some of us. And I think that's a crucial difference. And when we talk about displacement, I'll give you one example. You know, there are many refugees who have come to host countries and after they've been welcomed and given a place to stay and so on, and become citizens, there are some of these people who will say of the new refugees, those are the bad refugees. We were the good refugees. And this is a total example of self-interest versus solidarity. It's very human to give into self-interest, but it's very limited as well. And if we really believe that we ourselves should be treated better for whatever reason because of our own humanity, and that our humanity should not be stigmatized or demeaned in some way or violated, then we should be standing up for the humanity of everyone else as well. And that's what I mean by the politics of solidarity. And I think the politics of solidarity is what's going to save us. The politics of self-interest might save some of us, but it's not going to save all of us. And when we talk about something like climate disaster, displacement, climate refugees, and so on, the politics of solidarity is so important. If we only think of building walls and keeping people out, as in let's stop these climate refugees from coming into our country, that's a temporary fix. Because the problems that produce climate refugees are problems that we ourselves are involved in making, like militarism, consumerism, climate catastrophe from carbon consumption, and so on. And if we could solve those problems, we would be saving ourselves as well. That's the politics of solidarity, and it does require, you know, a more capacious imagination than only thinking about ourselves.
Hmm. You know, I brought the term up, Asian American, or in context of my country, Asian Canadian. It's a very, very broad brush when we talk about disparate Asian peoples and groups. And you talk about how, you know, on one hand, although we're all from different places or our heritages are from different places, we've had to come together in that sort of solidarity. But as you suggest, solidarity is so complex. You have called out anti-Black, anti-Brown, and anti-Native racism that you say runs deep in many Asian American communities.
Absolutely. If we look at this category of Asian, it's actually relatively meaningless because Asia is this vast, gigantic geographic entity. And what Asian means in different places is a complete social and political construct. And if we think about it in that way, then we recognize that, you know, being Asian is actually very, very flexible. And how we define it is actually based on solidarity, because there's no reason for someone who is South Asian or Indian, for example, to have any affiliation with someone who's Vietnamese. But if we construct that as an Asian category, then there is. And we do that because of political contingencies in our home countries and so on. And what that means is that, you know, 50 years ago, Vietnamese and Indians or South Asians and all these different populations wouldn't have had a reason to align themselves together, and now they do. If that's the case, then where are the limits of this solidarity? The limits are always shifting based upon what we think of as our affiliations and our constructed kinships. And so that's why there's hope for me. You know, that, you know, some time ago, you know, Koreans and Japanese wouldn't have considered themselves Asians together because of obvious of their history of conflict and colonization. But now in certain locations, they would. And so that's hopeful for me. And so that's why also in the essay that you talked about, where I said Asian Americans need to affiliate with Palestinians because we are all Asian in some broad sense. It's not just, you know, talking about that because of some geographical entity that we share. It's talking about that affiliation because of a political and a moral affiliation that, again, is based on this idea of an ever-expansive solidarity that's designed to save us all.
In an essay that you wrote for Time on the subject of model minorities, and you and I have spoken about model minorities and the myths and the realities of such notions, you wrote, quote, Asian Americans are caught between the perception that we are inevitably foreign and the temptation that we can be allied with white people. Flesh that out for me more.
That's a dilemma that I think Asians in the West find themselves in. It's a systemic contradiction, all right? Because Western countries, you know, the UK, Canada, the United States, and so on, they're built upon these notions of democracy, equality, opportunity, inclusion, and so on. And in that sense, immigrant and refugee populations like Asians should be included in these places. However, these countries are also all built in different ways on colonialism and exploitation that have often turned to Asia and to Asian migrants as sources of profit and labor and so on. And that is deeply and structurally embedded in these countries. And so that's the contradiction. Are we going to be are we as Asian migrants or as Asian Americans or Asian Canadians, are we going to be welcome because we are the model minority and we bring great things to these countries? Or are we going to be marginalized, excluded, targeted because we are seen as a foreign population that's only been useful for exploitation? So there is no easy resolution to this contradiction. It's a political and historical contradiction that can only be solved by addressing this radical inequality. So on the one hand, I would say it's great, obviously, in Canada and the United States that we do see celebrations of Asian culture. To be Asian diasporic or Asian American or Asian Canadian has a lot of positive things about it today that I didn't experience when I was growing up in the 1970s and 1980s. Younger generations have access to things like boba and K-pop and K-drama. Mm. And suddenly being Asian is cool. But yet at the same time, the fear of Asians has never gone away. So we can celebrate Asian culture on the one hand, and we can demonize them, as we have seen recently during the pandemic, by targeting Asians as somehow being foreign and bringers of disease and danger into these countries. These are signs of systemic contradiction that can only be resolved by fully confronting this really deeply problematic history that the West has had towards Asia and its migrants.
You have thought so deeply about your place, my place in the world, the complexities of all of that, about identity. And, you know, the big things that, and then they're the ones that are sort of maybe, I don't know, smaller example of the things that illuminate such a complex thing. And I want to ask you about your name. You and I grew up sort of in the same generation. And, you know, Pia was a quote unquote weird name when I was growing up. And people used to tell me it was weird. I don't hear that as much. I'm just wondering, your name is quote unquote unusual. What is your relationship with your own name and how has it evolved over time?
Well, I certainly grew up knowing that my name was weird in an American context. You know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and sometimes my classmates would say, oh, your first name is Viet. Is your last name Nam? You know, so all of us, I think, have been subject to these various kinds of pejorative insults and so on. And what's kind of sad is that we still see that happening today. If you look at Kamala Harris, I mean, the level of invective directed against her by certain kinds of Republicans is so juvenile and racist and so dispiriting. And it shows how endemic and enduring this problem is with names as signifiers of foreignness. And yet at the same time, it was very hard for me to give up my name. I could have changed my name when I became an American citizen. My parents offered me that opportunity and I tried on different names. I thought, what if I called myself Troy? You know, and it just makes you laugh, right?
Yeah, I just
feel yeah. Right.
Sorry to all the Troys. I'm not laughing at your name. I'm just laughing at the idea of you changing your name to Troy.
Exactly. And so I was very attached to my name. I felt it was one way for me to hang on to who I was in a country that I intuitively understood to be racist in so many ways. And so it's a struggle, obviously. But now I've reached a moment with my own name where it's really interesting that in California, in many places that I'll go, and even outside of California, people ask me, what's your name? And I'll say, my last name is Nguyen or Nguyen. And I start to spell it for them. And they'll say, oh, I know how to spell that name. Mm. And they're not Vietnamese. They're not even Asian. So, I mean, it's a struggle. But if we struggle, if we hang on, if we're stubborn, if we're defiant, we can actually budge the culture. Instead of us moving towards dominant culture, we can make dominant culture move towards us. And I take hope in that my son, who is named Ellison, you know, his last name is Nguyen, just as mine. And he's going to grow up with a totally different world in which I think he will be proud of that last name, and he knows how to pronounce that last name, and people will know how to spell it. And that is just one symptom of, you know, some signs of progress in terms of how Asian Canadians and Asian Americans have been able to transform the images of their country, of these countries, to include them in some ways.
Hmm. So Ellison is the name of your son, and your daughter's name is Simone, which is the title character and name of your new children's book. It's named after your daughter?
Yes, absolutely. And the book is named after her, not because of me, but because our editor, Maria Russo, after a long discussion of her possible book title, said, why don't we just call it Simone? And I thought, sure, of course, I would love to do that. And, you know, I named my children very deliberately. Ellison is named after Ralph Ellison, the great novelist, who's black and American. And Simone is named after Simone de Beauvoir and Nina Simone and other famous Simones of history. She now claims Simone Biles as a name herself. And so these names are meant to signify defiance and courage and power and accomplishment. And so for me, it's wonderful that the children's book has this title, not only because of my daughter, but because of what that name itself symbolizes.
Love it. Love it. Another name that is complicated, as you say, is the name America. You mentioned Kamala Harris. It is, of course, an election year in your country. There's so much discussion, debate about who and what gets to take that name, America, that word, and what it means. I'm just wondering, Viet, how are you thinking about these questions?
I think that names are signs of power. They're signs of identity. They're signs of power. We name people certain things. We name countries certain things. And then these names take on a life of their own. So I think that there are, you know, when we talk about America, it's a vast, you know, continent. But somehow the United States has come to appropriate that name just for itself. And there are a lot of people south of the American, the U.S. border who say we're Americans too. You know, and I think that that contestation, that struggle over the name of America is important, because the name of America has come to symbolize the American dream, but also American imperialism, American global hegemony, and things like that. So it's healthy to contest names. It's healthy to historicize them and to try to imbue them with different meanings. And so for me, as an American citizen, you know, I have a relationship to the United States that is ambivalent, because I do love the country. It's given me so many things, and I've accomplished so many things within the context of the United States. And yet I also realized that I wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for an American war in Vietnam, which in and of itself was not unique. The United States has fought many, many wars in different places that have brought many different kinds of people to this country. And so as an American, I feel obligated to wrestle with that contradiction between the possibilities that the country offers for some people and the sort of brutal history that has made the United States the country that it is. All of these things are wrapped up. All these things are very complex. And I think that as a citizen of any country, not just the United States, we all have an obligation not just to sing the praises of our country and to look at the good side, but also to address the full complexities and contradictions, which are oftentimes deeply uncomfortable.
I always so appreciate hearing what's going on in your head, what you're thinking about. And this children's book really is for everyone to think about these big issues. And I appreciate you so much. Thank you.
Thanks for giving me the chance to talk about Simone, Pia.
Viet Thanh Nguyen's new book for kids is called Simone. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.